Good morning. Welcome to the committee. We're come to order. Got a couple of bills to hear today. So I think without further ado, we'll get right to it. We've got to have got to look at the minutes here. So who's reviewed the minutes and would make the motion to approve?
Mr. Chair, I've read the minutes, and I move that we approve them.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Representative Lippert has moved the minutes to be approved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of approved minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved from our previous meeting on January 23. Our first agenda item today is House File 167. Representative Fu Lee, welcome. And I would, I'll move that House File 167 be that's before us, that we hear this bill and that it be referred to Ways and Means. So we have an author's amendment. Representative Lee, would you? Well, I'll move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape you want it, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Does everybody have the amendment? Any questions on what we're looking at here?
So,
Representative Papin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly to that point, you know, the amendment was, and I overheard the conversation. I don't know what we need to change a little bit in the system to get the amendments posted earlier and so forth. If you could address that, please.
Specifically, you didn't see it in the time frame that you, the 24 hours?
I think the amendment was posted last night at roughly, was it 7 o'clock, 6:30, something like that, and I thought that, I mean, for the public, you know, it's nice to do that, and I appreciate that your CA is a busy person as well, and I'm assuming it's probably a one-time deal, but I do think that it's important to have a conversation. And if his schedule is such that, you know, it doesn't work out very well to get it done by 3 o'clock, which I think is kind of what we talked about for the rules. I'm sorry I don't remember them. I'm just interested in your feedback, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'll just offer to you that we'll try and get those few more hours out there so you have opportunity. And any specific questions on the amendment?
No, thank you.
Okay, so everybody has seen the amendment. I would just ask, move that amendment. Ask for those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Chair, aye. Opposed? Amendment is approved. Representative Lee, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 167. And just quickly to the amendment, I just want to say thank you to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health for working with me on this amendment to address some of the feedbacks. Members, this bill aims to address an important concern my constituents and I have when the state enters into enforcement settlements with polluters in our communities. The community members who will be testifying after me today no longer wants to be left out of conversations on how settlement funds can be used to address their health concerns. There's a need for diagnostic screening, testing, and treatment programs for communities exposed to pollutions. This environmental injustice issue was brought to me when a metal recycling company in my district was found to have violated multiple air standards. For background information, the MPCA have been air monitoring this recycling company since January 2013. And to date, two monitoring sites adjacent to a recycling company has found elevated levels of airborne particulate and heavy metals. The results identify violations of the daily and annual total suspended particulate TSP standards, exceedance of the daily PMT standard, elevated lead concentration measured at 80% of the national lead standard, and elevated heavy metal concentration, including three metals, chromium, cobalt, and nickel, measured above chronic inhalation health risk benchmarks. With these results, in March 2017, the MPCA agreed to a $2.5 million settlement with a recycling company to move its metal shredder, pay a penalty fee, reimburse the state's costs, and $600,000 to the City of Minneapolis for community health projects. This level of funding for community health projects is concerning to my constituents because we have some of the highest health disparities in the state. The Minneapolis Health Department has identified the neighborhoods surrounding the recycling facility as areas of concentrated poverty where 50% or more of the residents are people of color and are at risk for both asthma and lead poisoning. From the state perspective, we know that lower socioeconomic status has been consistently associated with greater harm from air pollution. We should act with urgency to help our communities throughout the state who are at risk of premature death from fine particulate pollution. I'm bringing this bill forward because I do not want the state to systematically fail in addressing the health concerns of communities who have been impacted by pollution. To my bill, it provides for offers of supplemental environmental projects, or SEPs, in enforcement actions against polluters. As members may know, the MPCA have used SEPs in enforcement settlement before to provide extra environmental and public health benefits. These are projects which a regulated party or respondent agreed to undertake in settlement of an enforcement action, but which the regulated party or respondent is not otherwise legally required to perform. My bill requires the PCA commissioner in consultation with the Department of Health to offer a public health SAP project when the pollution in question results in measurable impacts on the health of the population exposed. In other words, the PCA is required to offer this voluntary program that reduces the penalty for the respondent and has benefit for the community. If a project is accepted, the bill requires the commissioners of PCA and Health to approve the public health project content and certify the project's completion. My bill also requires the commissioner to ensure that the community actively participates in developing a public health SEP. With that, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative. Would you please introduce your first testifier and introduce yourself and into the mic, too, please. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you for this opportunity, Chair, to speak on behalf of Bill 167. My name is Roxanne O'Brien, and I'm from North Minneapolis. And just real quick before I start my testimony, two people died last night from the cold because our communities are lacking resources that we need and access to proper housing and other environmental and justice issues. So I just wanted to have a moment of silence for those two people last night in my neighborhood.
I think that's in order. Thank you. Moment of silence, please. Very good.
Please. Thank you. So me and other community members today have braved the cold and the difficulties in coming in here today because of the need to improve the legacy of environmental pollution in our state's low-income and communities of color is so great. These are families and residential areas co-located near highways, industrial sites, and heavy truck traffics. These activities generate cumulative hotspot areas of pollution that, when put together, have contributed to the significant health disparities in our State Department has been documenting. For example, exposure to particulate matter pollution is linked to many health conditions such as asthma, chronic bronchitis, reduced lung function, irregular heartbeat, heart attack, and premature death. This has broader impacts such as school attendance, missed work days, and ongoing respiratory health challenges, developmental disabilities, and dangers of lead poisoning. A 2014 University of Minnesota study showed people of color are exposed to nearly 40% more polluted air than whites. And Minnesota is among the top 15 states in the nation with the largest exposure gaps between people of color and whites. In the Twin Cities alone, a recent NPCA and MDH study showed that in 2008, fine particulate pollution caused an estimated 2,152 deaths, 321 hospitalizations for heart and lung conditions, and 402 emergency department visits for asthma. This was particularly significant for elderly people, people of color, and low-income people because they are more likely to suffer from health conditions that are further aggravated by air pollution. The pollution sources or facilities that violate state regulations have penalties. However, the communities that receive the burden of the pollution, of their pollution, do not necessarily receive remediation or benefit from those penalties. This bill changes that, working to connect the line to help those communities most impacted by the pollution violation. While we still have a long way to go in achieving healthy air, water, and land for all, true environmental justice in Minnesota, this bill is an excellent way forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, please proceed. Your next testifier, Mr. Paulson. That's why I have Nels Paulson, but you don't look like Nels Paulson, but introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Danielle Tejan, and I represent the Falwell Neighborhood Association, impacted in the neighborhood that Roxanne lives in. And I'm here to support her. An expert in our community, an expert on the work and fight for environmental justice. My job working for a neighborhood organization is to uplift the residents in the community, to fight for the things that are impacting them and important to them. A lot of that rests on equity and access. For me, our job working for communities, and especially in bodies of government, is to be working with people and hear the concerns that they have and to center humanity at the work that we do. And there is a ton of disparity that is impacting North Minneapolis, specifically right around the highway and all of the industrial plants. And people don't often know why they are getting sick, and one sick day from work can be the deciding factor on whether they have jobs or not. If kids are getting sick and parents need to stay home, my job is to make sure that we center people at the work that we do. And while funding and policy and legislation is necessary for making sure that we have equitable policies moving forward, we can't forget the people that have suffered from it already, and making sure that we build trust with the people that we represent and that we work for, and making sure that they're at the center of our solutions. That's why I'm here.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Thank you. We have a couple more testifiers. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. So my name is C. Terrence Anderson. I'm a resident of North Minneapolis, same neighborhood. I'm also the director of community-based research and community programs at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota. So here testifying as a resident. I think the important thing that I wanted to talk about today, in this conversation on equity, we can think about it as a material aspect, the things that people get, the resources that they need to overcome the different circumstances that they have in their life. But I also want to talk about it as a process, or the process by which equity happens. So I like to say that equity is just as much as a healing process for people as it is a material process, a material outcome for communities. At the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs, or CURA, we like to talk about an equity model. And in our equity model, we think there's three distinct points that we need to do if we're living through an equity-centered process. That's contextualization, community-centeredness, and reparative. We like to say contextualize. So when we're doing equity work, we're contextualizing in the harm that has been done. So this bill talks about polluters, people in noncompliance that has effects in our community. The bill lays that out very clearly. It's important to think about that thing first. And then the second part in community-centeredness, the communities that are most impacted by that harm are at the forefront of finding the solutions. So this bill talks about community participation. It's identifying who is significant in having that conversation and who this conversation is for. And then three, ultimately the solutions that we find are equal in impact as the harm that was been done. So what is the reparative aspect of which this bill centers us in doing? But to say this in a more colloquial way, I would ask each folks, if I was to hurt you as an individual and in our relationship, who gets to define the process for your healing and what it means to be healed? I think most of you would say that the person that was hurt is the people that get to define the process for the healing, what it means for them to be healed. So that community participation element is something that is very significant. So we don't allow that when we don't do that sincerely and authentically and intentionally. We rob people of their agency about what it means for them to be healed and how that means for them to be healed. And so I'm very supportive of this bill because I think it lends language and intention, excuse me, towards that end. And so I encourage for the bill to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Guest Fire? No, not at this time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Are there some more testifiers? Gently? Okay.
This is turned out for me.
Okay. A couple people evidently couldn't make it, perhaps. But please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, members. My name is Nels Paulson. I'm the policy director at Conservation Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Lee for introducing House File 167. And in your packets, I think there's a letter of support from Conservation Minnesota. I wanted to highlight the fourth paragraph of that letter. I referenced something called environmental anxieties. And I know that Representative Lee is acutely aware of anxieties in his own district, specifically because of Northern Metals. But I wanted to talk to the committee that these environmental anxieties are things that we hear from people all across the state. It's certainly not just limited to Representative Lee's district. Certainly in the East Metro, many of us are aware of the 3M settlement, and I've had dozens of conversations in the last few years with Conservation Minnesota members and just general Minnesota citizens who are concerned about a lifetime of drinking that water in the East Metro, and they want to know, is it safe and what kind of health impacts has it had on me or my children? And I've heard similar concerns from Conservation Minnesota members in the southeast region of Minnesota, where the karst geology has allowed for or can allow for pollutants to get into drinking water relatively quickly. But the point I'm trying to make about this is that statewide, all Minnesotans or many Minnesotans pay attention to things like, is the air safe for me to breathe, or is the water safe for me to drink? And I think that Representative Lee's bill elevates another tool in the MPCA enforcement toolbox where the agency can go into a community that's affected and say, this specific public health supplemental environmental project is designed to address the concerns that you are bringing to us. And I think this tool will help build trust with potentially impacted communities, and it will help alleviate some of the environmental anxieties that communities may face when there's a permit violation, a spill, or a release. And I think everyone would agree that at this time, building trust between state government and communities all across Minnesota is something that this body should work towards and support. And thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Representative Baby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paulson, you talk about anxiety and drinking water and so forth. So specifically, the calls that you've received, what message do you give to people to calm their anxieties? You know, I have children and grandchildren, and they're anxious about various things from time to time, and as a parent and a grandparent, obviously we try to calm those anxieties and present them with real information as opposed to something that's not accurate.
Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fabian. I think that's a great question. And oftentimes at Conservation Minnesota, we are just connecting people to answers or to more information at other locations. Oftentimes that's the Department of Health or the MPCA. And I don't, if you recall, last week there was a hearing about landfills, and I think Representative Becker Finn was concerned about landfill and some impacts it had in her community. And it took a few answers from the MPCA to alleviate those concerns, because sometimes the right person is not answering the question that community members have. So we try and pay attention to things that happen here. Oftentimes we'll encourage the agency to maybe improve their website or change the way they talk about something so that it's easier for members of the public to understand. And oftentimes we connect Conservation Minnesota members to you guys, to legislators, because sometimes we don't know the answer, and we look to you guys for help then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paulson, you said, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said in your testimony that people had contacted you about whether or not the drinking water was safe in this community that we're talking about today. Do you know if the drinking water is safe or not? And if not, and you weren't able to answer that question on the phone, did you get back to those people that contacted you with the correct information?
Thank you, Paul. Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I think most of the concern that Representative Lee has had in his district is about airborne pollutants. But pollutants in any sort, water, air, people contact us, and we feel an obligation to make sure we connect them. If we don't know the answer, that we connect them with someone who does. So we always try and get back to people with as much information as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Paulson, you stated specifically in your testimony, I believe, that you had concerns raised to you about the drinking water in this community. Who then did you direct those people to contact with regards to whether or not the drinking water was safe?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, if I mentioned that people were concerned about drinking water in Representative Lee's district, that was a misstatement. Okay. People have contacted us about other drinking water situations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks so much, Representative Lee, for bringing this legislation forward, and to the community members who came out. I know a lot of these folks, because they are, you know, Ms. O'Brien in particular, I've worked at the city of Minneapolis for a number of years, and she just fights so hard for her community and lifting up these issues for many, many years. And so I'm really grateful to you for being here, because this work is not easy. Because, you know, I don't know how much other members of the community know about lead poisoning. You know, in the Hawthorne neighborhood, which is like right across the street from Northern Metals, they say that 10% of six-year-olds have actionable levels of lead in their blood, which is 5 micrograms per deciliter, which is a standard that's set at the federal level that has been, it's been lowered several times over the years. I mean, I remember even when, you know, I have a six-year-old, and I think when he was born it was at 10, and then in his life it's been lowered again to 5. And if you actually read the research about exposure to blood or to lead, especially, you know, in utero and for babies, there is actually no safe level. There are cognitive impacts measured at the lowest level that they're able to measure. They can discern cognitive and behavioral impacts decades later. So, like 1 in 10 kids in this neighborhood are potentially experiencing lead poisoning, which has an impact on school performance, on you know, measurable cognitive function later in life, on the executive functioning and the ability to kind of control one's behavior. So this is like it's a poisonous brain, like toxin that impacts children's brains, and we have facilities around our state that are allowed to exist in really close proximity to children who are not only experiencing impacts from lead, right? That's the other thing, is that there is a, you know, they talked in here about measuring cumulative levels and effects. So when a child has other vulnerabilities, which include like poverty and stress and like having to deal with racism and having to deal with economic oppression, the effects can be amplified. And so, you know, I guess I just want to say that, like, this was a really extraordinary thing that happened, that there was a $2.5 million consent decree from this company, which, if you kind of, like, look at the progression of the regulatory activities against this company, they were not in compliance repeatedly. They were misrepresenting the facts to the Pollution Control Agency. You know, in my opinion, they haven't been a good actor. And so I guess I have a question about the legislation. I'm sorry to go into that. This is an issue that's so important to people in my community. And I don't know if any parent in the room who's sitting on this committee has ever, like, had the experience of going to the doctor and hearing that their kid had too high a level of lead, but it's just an incredibly devastating experience. And we have people who live in this neighborhood whose children are will need a lifetime of extra care and will not be able to fully participate in their lives because of the actions of companies that we have permitted to emit air pollutants, right? As a state. And so I'm interested in the portion of this legislation that says, well, I guess I'm reading the overview from House Research, but basically, like, that this is an optional kind of, like an option that the PCA has to present to a company that they're engaging, or, you know, that they're engaging in remedial actions with, right, that they're levying a fine against. And to me, like, the whole thing about issues of, you know, disproportionate impact in urban areas, it's that a specific concentrated population is bearing the burden of environmental activities, and the benefit goes to a much broader, like, group of people. So even here, right, it's like scrap metal recyclers. So this small population in North Minneapolis that's located very close to this facility, to, like, a point source of pollution, is bearing this huge burden. And who's benefiting from metal recycling? Like, it's a much larger group of people. It's not just people in North Minneapolis. It's not just people in the Hawthorne neighborhood. And so to me, it's like the idea of having a remedy against a company that has a very local impact, and putting that money into the general fund, and then saying, oh, like, if you want, then you could put it into this public health fund that will actually maybe repair, to C. Terrence's point, right, that will maybe hit that third point of restoration, which is the way that we should be approaching our work. You can put money in there, but you don't have to. To me, I guess that's what I'm wondering, is, like, is there a way to make it so that this isn't left to, like, the goodwill of the company that has violated our air standards? And is there a way to just make it so that it's not optional, you know?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gomez, you know, that is a question that I ask myself too, and I ask, you know, all of our colleagues, what are we doing to help address the concerns of the communities who are directly impacted? And to this point, I would say that this is the best proposal that I have to addressing this concern, and so that's why I'm bringing it forth now. And, you know, I'm still working in consultation with our state agencies, and, you know, I will welcome the opportunities for other members, you know, who care about this issue to work with me to address this issue so that, you know, communities, you know, the impact we have seen in my community, but I do not want this to impact other communities throughout the state of Minnesota. And so that's why I'm bringing this forward and really hoping that all of you will join me in how finding a way to address the concerns that our local communities have.
Thank you.
Good
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee. I'm very supportive of this, and I'm excited to vote for it. And I guess I just want to, I don't know, are there MPCA staff in the room?
Yes.
Okay. Hi. So as a community member, I guess it was a bunch of years ago at this point, Roxanne and I and a number of other community members were involved in developing an environmental justice framework for the state of Minnesota that was in consultation with the head of the MPCA at the time, Commissioner Stein. And the idea was basically that, it was a way to acknowledge the disproportionate impact on certain communities of environmental toxics and to basically we developed some, like, diagnostic criteria, like, isn't the right way to talk about it, but like there's a screening basically to say, like, we're using certain standards to identify geographic areas of concern, and then we are being more intentional around certain aspects of the agency's function in those areas, including rulemaking, permitting. And there's a really great effort at operationalizing and kind of like baking that environmental justice framework into the work of the PCA. And so I'm interested in, this isn't like a critique of this proposal, but just if there is a way for us to possibly using the EJ framework to maybe even in just certain geographies to say we have vulnerable populations in this area that we know are much more likely to suffer ill health effects because of the, actions of industry and because of choices that are made around placing freeways in certain places and kind of all these like spatial decisions that get made by policymakers. And that maybe we can, in areas of high concern around environmental justice issues, again, take that, make it so that it's not just a choice, so that we say, oh, if we are levying a fine against a permitted facility in a certain area that has been identified as sensitive, that we're putting a certain percentage of that fine into one of these funds that really like targets the interventions back into the community. So I guess that's a question, like, is something like that possible?
Ms. Gauthier, if you want to come up by or from MPCA, if there are others too, I would just offer to your last point there, Representative Gomez, that sounds like where we're headed with this bill. What you said about we're going, trying to make the possibility of more local. So that sounds good. Ms. Gauthier, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for your question, Representative Gomez. And yes, we do, under the previous administration, there was an emphasis on environmental justice at the agency, and an environmental justice advisory committee was set up to work with the commissioner, and we do have an environmental justice framework as well. I think the question is, I'm not sure, but maybe I could get a clarification.
Sure. So the question is, like, can we make this not optional, and maybe just in certain areas? Can we say if we're going to levy a fine in an area that meets the screening criteria that we established in the environmental justice framework, that we're going to take, I don't know what percentage of the fine and put it into one of these funds so that the community that is directly impacted by the issue that led to the fine actually gets some of the remediation? And not just make it like, oh, it's an option that we have to tell the company about and depend on the company's sort of goodwill.
Ms. Gauthier, and I would offer, Representative Gomez, that some of that's up to us.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know, but what I can do, I do have with me a person who might be able to talk more about it, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Jeff Smith. I'm the Director of the Industrial Division at the MPCA.
This has been a great discussion and one that's very, very important to the agency. As Representative Gomez said, we've been working through our environmental justice framework now. I think we're on year four of that, and while we've got some work ahead of us, we really have committed our past commissioner and our current commissioner really have directed us and committed us to working on environmental justice issues in particular. It's been an important part of Commissioner Stein's legacy, and it will be for us going forward under Commissioner Bishop. The question about can funds be directed or must they be directed, it really is up to this legislature on whether you'd want us to do that. We don't have a strong feeling one way or another right now. It is an option that we present to regulated parties. They have a choice under supplemental environmental project requirements or options under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. That's federal requirements. We always offer that to folks if they want to take that up. But in most cases, while probably less than half of the projects that we do that have SEPs, negotiated settlements, do people opt to do those SEPs and have money directed back to environmental projects. So, Mr. Chair, as you said, that is a possibility, but it would need to be directed and put forward by the legislature.
So I'd just offer there can be further discussions on this with Representative Lee's bill, and I think that'd be a good place to go, sit down, have a conversation, Representative Gomez, and then we can move from there. I'd like to Representative Heintzman, I have you on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like we're kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of this bill, so I have some questions along those lines for the bill author. And if Ms. Gauthier, maybe you want to stick around, I have a question relative to the agency first. I'm seeing in line 3.6 on down subdivision 4, community participation, the commissioner must ensure, and then there's several paragraphs here describing the activity that the agency will be engaged in, and it's not a may, it's a directive to MPCA. And I'm wondering, has there been an arrangement that has taken up, or is there an estimate of the costs that would be generated throughout all of this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Heintzman. We are working on that. A fiscal note has not been required, but there probably would be some costs around more coordination, needing more coordination and liaison effort with communities, and needing more modeling work for either air, probably mostly air modeling, and then probably some admin support to the extent that we would have public health SEPs were this law put into place. But I understand this bill will go to the Finance Committee next, so we might be able to look at it there or at some point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Lee, has a fiscal note been requested? Where are we at on there? I mean, I'm assuming as you're developing this idea that it's very obvious that the agency is going to acquire some costs. Where's the fiscal note at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, so to date, fiscal notes have not been requested. And I do want to note that one of the reasons why I have not requested that yet is that the language right here is that the commissioner must offer, but it is up to the respondent to decide if they want to take on the project. Mm-hmm. So when I was in conversation with the PCA, they mentioned that, you know, if this was to be passed in law, there will be roughly around 10 cases per year. But at the end of the day, it is still up to the individuals or the respondents to decide if they want to accept the offer. So that is one of the reasons why we haven't requested, but my understanding is that if this moves on in the process, it will be going towards the Finance Committee, and that's something that's appropriate for me to put in a fiscal note for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just along those lines going forward here, you said the commission must offer. I'm reading here the commissioner must ensure that before developing specific activities. And then in line 3.13, the commissioner must submit a report. It costs money to submit a report. I'm confused why a fiscal note hasn't been requested. And then I'm also wondering, is there a companion to this in the Senate? I'm not seeing one. Is there one moving, or what's happening on the other
side? Let me just interject here, please. Representative Heintzman, this is going to go to a fiscal committee, so your question is going to be answered there about finances. I don't want to get too far in the weeds on that, but please answer the questions as you can, Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, so I will say that because in order for them to have the community participation, the respondent should have accepted the agreement or the projects. And so if there's no project, then there wouldn't be community participation under this. And then with regards to the questions about the Senate, the jackets have been sent over to my senator, and it is my understanding that the senator will be introducing the bill.
A couple more questions here, and I apologize. We got another bill here, so I have Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, I guess. First of all, and this is for Representative Lee, we've heard some important testimony from folks in your area. Do you have a testifier from the Department of Health that can provide a little more purely data-based analysis of the, for example, the issue with lead poisoning? We know that's very dangerous, particularly to newborns. So you do have another testifier. I don't see him on the list. Maybe I missed it. The assumption is there'll be a testifier that will speak to the health hazards.
Representative Lee, and I see somebody jumped up from the audience. I don't know who that individual is, but they may be a
person. Mr. Chair, Melissa Finnegan from the Department of Health. She was not on the testifier list like Representative Loic mentioned, but she may be able to speak on this.
Conveniently here, and thank you. And introduce yourself for the record. And I want you to answer the question, then I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Health. And I will apologize to you, Representative. Our content expert, who would be able to answer those questions for you, is quite pregnant, so I encouraged her to stay home this morning for her health and safety. If you do have specific questions, we can touch base afterwards, and I can get those answers to you.
Ms. Chair, I've got a whole lot of questions, although I understand the data. So since we do have a member that can speak for the Department of Health, we name in here a third-party entity that would be involved collecting data, doing things. I guess if you and your leadership determined how exactly you would oversee that, or are you just going to rely on the MPCA to look at those very specific health issues?
I think we would work very, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I think we would work very closely in partnership with the MPCA, and you know, we work closely with a lot of local partners. In the case of the City of Minneapolis, a partner we would like to work with would be the Minneapolis Department of Public Health, our local partner there.
So if I understand you, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand it correctly, then the third party would be another government entity?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I use that as an example, but I think between the Department of Health and MPCA and the community, we would work closely to determine the best partners to do that outreach and effort.
This would be a question more for Representative Lee. I don't see anything in here specific to the data that very likely is going to be dealt with if you get into a deep public health issue, surveys and that type of thing. So how do you plan on handling the data with this, and is that another committee stop that you anticipate having this bill make?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Lloyd, for the question. I appreciate you bringing that up to my attention, and I will work with staff from the Department of Health to see what we need with regards to the health data that may be needed for this project.
And just one more quick question, and I would make the assumption that this bill is probably going to spend a fair amount of time in a committee that has jurisdiction over the Department of Health, simply because you go into a community and do the important things that are necessary if you do have a specific health problem there. That I would just offer is probably more of the purview of the folks in the health department than it is. I mean, it's a team effort, but we're talking about human health here, and we do have another agency that is very important in that area. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well put, Representative Lewis. Thank you. A couple more on the list here. Representative Lisberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as I looked through this, I was looking for my attorney hat, and obviously I don't have one because I'm not an attorney. and I thank you for coming to my office and letting me and helping me a little bit with this. So I see this, and I'm very, very sympathetic to the challenges and the impact it's having on people. But I have obviously some concerns. What is the definition of community and third party? Right. So when your MPCA and the health department, is that the city of Minneapolis? I mean, because community is the people within. But is it the government agency that is going to be working with the city, the community, with all these other parts or facets of the community? You understand what I'm saying, Mr.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative Lizagar. So the intent of the community is for the community that has been exposed to the pollution. And so if that's not clear in here, that's something that I can work on with staff to make that clear. That is for the community that has been exposed to the pollution.
Mr. Chair, so when you're coming up with the MPCA or whoever it is coming up with a plan with the polluters, if that's what it's deemed, who's going to make the final decision whether it's acceptable or not? The agency, the community, or the third party?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lizagar, so that's why we have the language after talking to the Department of Health and the Department of PCA for the PCA to be in consultation with the Department of Health to when looking at the certain factors that we have when they're determining if an offer must be made. So it is for the two commissioners to work in conjunction with each other to see if the project is appropriate to proceed.
Thank you.
Okay. President Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions for MPCA and also for the author, but Representative Lee, you, on page 2 of the bill, 2.11, you say that the commissioner may offer regulated facilities. And then on 2.15, you say that the commissioner must offer regulated facilities. Can you tell me why you have may and must there?
So if nonpartisan staff could chime in on this, too. So the may for the supplemental environmental project, I believe that's the directive that's coming from the federal government as an opportunity for our states to offer subs. And then, you know, what we're here today to talk about is to address some of the public health concerns that my communities have had. And so that's why for that specific piece, I'm asking, or, you know, the language is must for the commissioner to offer when they have seen that there's a public health need for the project, and so that's why, you know, the language will have them to work with the Department of Health on that issue. And
I'm going to ask Mr. Ehlers if he would so advise here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. Yes, the supplemental environmental project is a general term. There are a number of different types of projects within that, one of which is the public health supplemental environmental project. What this bill says is, you're correct, that the commissioner may offer a supplemental environmental project of a different type, pollution prevention, restoration of the environment. But because Representative Lee is specifically interested in these public health supplemental projects, that's one that's required to be offered if the commissioner determines that the pollution may result in measurable health impacts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, MPCA, we heard Mr. Smith testify, Commissioner Smith, Assistant Commissioner, that they are already doing this, and something about some federal guidelines or regulations. Can you give me clarity on that?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Gauthier?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, yes, I'll do that.
Just reintroduce yourself, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the MPCA. There are some very specific requirements laid out through the Federal Clean Air Act and the Federal Clean Clean Water Act that describe how a supplemental environmental project must be applied to a settlement. They are very prescriptive and in some ways very limiting. I think that what we're seeing here offered in this bill is expands that, gives us more options to apply those SEPs in different ways that impact public health as well as environmental restoration. So in that sense, it's different than what the federal requirement currently lays out for supplemental environmental projects. Hopefully that helped answer the question, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, could you be more specific on how it gives you more flexibility? Because as I understand, you're already doing all this stuff kind of through a guidance document, if that's the correct term. What does this bill allow you to do that you can't currently do through your guidance?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what it does is what the federal law currently does is it specifies that the SEPs must apply to the type and the form of the violations or exceedances. And so in that sense, it's more about a facility change or what the facility can do in terms of putting together environmental projects that will change the emissions from that facility. So it's very specific in that sense. What this language does is it allows us to look into the community and offer some projects more extensively or in a more expansive way that impact human health versus just the environment, which is what the federal language kind of is very much focused on.
I'm going to ask Mr. Ela for his clarifications here.
Mr. Chair, I think I can clarify this. What this bill does is require the commissioner, when the commissioner determines that measurable public health impacts may have been made, to make this offer of a public health supplemental environmental project. Neither EPA's guidance nor the PCA's guidance currently requires that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you. I appreciate the clarification. So then, I'm interested in now the public health supplemental environmental project. I'd like some specific examples of what those projects are.
Anybody want to take that on?
I go.
Do you want MPCA to? I don't know.
Well, I think they're going to, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, they're the ones who are going to be administering this program, and it would seem to me that if this is already in our guidance documents and it's in federal rules and so forth, there must be something there that we've already done. I'm open to whoever wants to testify.
Let's hear MPCA, and then I'd offer to hear our witness here.
Mr. Chair, members, yeah, this is sort of cutting edge for us. We don't typically get involved with human health beneficial projects. We're usually working with the facility to make changes to the type and the form of emissions, in this case on an air side, that they would put into place. In this case, the example that I can think of is one around the Northern Metal settlement. And in that sense, I think, and Ms. O'Brien may speak to that, that it was directed to the city. The $600,000 was directed to the city for a project that would enhance and benefit their lead assessment in individual homes. So it's going down to connecting the emissions from Northern Metals and how that impacts individual residents or nearby neighborhoods. And in this case, a project that some of the money is being used, as I understand it, to be used for assessments of lead impacts around individual homes, which the city of Minneapolis already does, but this is to kind of build up and bolster that project already. That is not something the agency would typically do as a SEP under the federal guidance, but as I understand, that might be applied here under this language.
And And before I ask you to testify, I'm going to ask Mr. Eliff again for his input on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fagan, I drafted this bill, and I borrowed some language from our friends at the EPA, and this is EPA has a SEP policy, which was updated in 2015, and here's what they say about public health projects. Public health projects include those that provide diagnostic, preventative, and or health care treatment related to the actual or potential harm to human health caused by the violation. This includes, but is not limited to, epidemiological data, collection and analysis, medical examinations of potentially affected persons, collection and analysis of blood, fluid, tissue samples, medical treatment, and rehabilitation therapy. Examples of public health SEPs include blood level testing, asthma screening, and treatment in mobile health clinics.
Go to her. You can.
You're okay. The chair, Mr. Chair.
I'll ask the testifier to reintroduce yourself real quick and be as succinct as you can, please.
Okay. So I've been working as a volunteer for 7 years around this Northern Meadows issue, and I would say this is an organic new thing that the community and the city and the state agencies have been collaborating together. It's been a long battle, but I think that that is a prime example of how when you allow community members to participate in their own communities and to make decisions around our health and our healing, this is an example of us winning together and building more trust, more relationships, and doing things that really impact the communities that were affected in the first place. So I would suggest other people who are interested in finding out more about it to just watch what the city of Minneapolis is doing right now, because I think that we're getting closer to something that you all can actually use in the future for future environmental justice bills.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to MPCA again, or the author, Representative Lee, if one of these projects is proposed or is offered by the commissioner, let's just hypothetically say that a polluter was being fined $200,000. I don't know. Pick a number. Mr. Smith, you know this stuff better than I do. If the option is presented to them to do a supplemental, is the cost then of this environmental project, health environmental project, borne by the polluter? And if so, is that then subtracted from the fine? How is this administered and managed that way? And I might point out, too, Mr. Chair, that as I read the bill, this is an offer. This is not something that's required, Representative Lee, correct?
But I think the bill does talk to your question there explicitly. So please take that on, Representative Lee. You want to take that?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, so right now, like I said, DPCA has been offering the SEP project before, and maybe the PCA will be able to better explain how they are currently enforcing that, and that may answer your question for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, right now the SEP project does not go into the details that is currently laid out. Our SEP projects do not typically have this level of monitoring, modeling, community assessment, and those sorts of issues going forward. I think one of our concerns that we shared with Representative Lee going forward was who will bear the burden of the costs. There certainly will be, as laid out, there certainly will be an increased cost to the agency to do the assessments, especially on the air side, the modeling required. It is not clear to us at this point whether all of that will be paid for by the regulated parties, or if we will be expected to do that portion of that under our current budgeted authority.
Mr. Chair, so I don't think that's a response that I have received from the staff working on this over at the PCA. And one of the responses they have said that if a violator accepts the offer, the SEP is explicitly spelled out in the enforcement document, including exactly what must accomplish by when and include steps they must take to improve completion. For example, submit receipts, photos, copies of work, etc. And if the step is not completed, the amount of the penalty that it offset become due.
I'm going to ask Mr. Elip to...
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Wisdom here.
I think I have the answer to your question, Representative Fabian, and this is from the PCA's own SEP guidance, where it says, the civil penalty assessed against the regulated party as part of an enforcement action may be reduced by an amount not to exceed the amount spent by a regulated party to implement SEP. The amount of reduction of the civil penalty is generally not equal to the amount of money spent to implement a SEP, but rather is a fraction of the implementation costs.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the questions and answers here, obviously. I can see a couple of other stops that this bill is probably going to need to make at data practices and health and so forth, but we'll see. I am particularly concerned on page one of the bill, I believe it is. I think we are all interested in data practice, data privacy, and so forth. I had just, like, really red flags go up when I was reading about the Public Health Supplemental Environmental Project. So on line 1.19, and then we start talking about collection and analysis of epidemiological data, collection analysis of blood, fluid, tissue samples, medical examinations of potentially affected persons, and medical treatment and rehabilitation therapy. This really raises some red flags for me in terms of data privacy. Who's going to be collecting this information? Is it going to be required that people submit to data collection? What assurances do we have that this stuff is going to be kept private? And this is really serious stuff. So to the author, if you would answer the question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, like I have mentioned before, I will be working with the Department of Health to talk about some of the data privacy laws, and we could work this through. And I understand that this will be going through the process, and if we need to go through to the Civil Law Committee too, I will work with staff and the two agencies to see how we can make this work for everyone to protect the data privacy of our citizens, residents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, when you've already had conversations seemingly with the Department of Health, I'm not sure. I mean, what assurances did you get from them in those preliminary conversations in terms of time leading up to drafting this bill with regards to data privacy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, so we did not specifically have conversation about the data privacy part of it, too. And like I said, this is going to go through the process, and I'll be reaching out to them about this issue specifically.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, one last thing.
Please.
I know you're under time constraints here. To the author of the bill, this is really quite new. I'm just curious, is there another state? Is there a place where this language, is there a template for this? I applaud you for your work, but where does this come from? Is there something else that I can look at to see what other entities are doing?
Representative Fabian, if I may, I'm going to ask Mr. Elip, is that a reasonable question, Mr. Elip, or do you, where the language comes from?
Mr. Chair, it's certainly a reasonable question. And I'm just not aware of any other states that do it this way. We're taking a voluntary decision on the part of the PCA commissioner and making this part with respect to public health SEPs required. But the offer be required.
It shows how smart our research staff is, huh?
I think if nothing else, we've shown that we've got a good bill here. And good bills are like making sausage, and we're making good sausage, so. Thank you for bringing this bill. Representative Green, I got you on the list here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say that most of my questions have been answered, and in the interest of time, I will wait till this comes to the Environmental Finance Committee, but I will share the fact that the data collection, it seems pretty intrusive, and not just for You know, when this stuff is collected, who's going to get it? What's it going to be used for? Is it going to be used to open up new lawsuits? But even more importantly than that, the private data of the people that are there to collect these things, and now this information's out there in the hands of a third party. And we know from experience that just because that third party may or may not be a government entity, it's not always secure. And when you take into consideration that between the Department of Health, the MPCA, and the statutes that the city itself has here, all the things seem to be already being done. Yeah. And so, you know, we'll talk about it again in the next committee, but thank you for the time. And
thanks for your input, Representative Green.
It's okay.
Okay. So any public testimony that anybody hasn't been heard that wants to be heard? Come forward here. Introduce yourself to the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Purcell, and my name is Daryl Gerber. I'm a panelist with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I know you want to get on to Representative Becker Finn's bill really quickly, so I will, you know, I think there's been some really good points brought up by previous testifiers, and I just want to offer our support and thanks to Representative Lee for this bill.
Thank you for your comments. Any other testimony? Seeing none, closing comments, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, as we can see from the debates and discussions today that, you know, this is a complex issue, and I welcome all the questions and, you know, be working with staff and the different agencies, and, you know, I welcome the opportunities for all of the members on the committees, you know, if you have additional concerns, to reach out to me, because the most important thing at the end of the day is how could our communities, you know, have their health concerns addressed with some of these settlement enforcement that we're entering into, and actually have the voices heard and say that, you know, our units of government are actually listening and responding to the concern. And so going forward, if you all have any other concern with the bill or any other ideas, feel free to reach out to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jim Lee. And hearing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion to recommend House File 167 as be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Welcome. Madam Vice Chair, Representative Becker Finn, let me get my notes in front of me.
Yep.
So our next item is House File 133, and would you move your bill, please?
Yep, and so I would move House Bill 133, I believe it would be referred to Ways and Means on its way to Environment Finance.
Very good.
And then, I, Mr. Chair, I do have a very short one-word author's amendment, an oral amendment. So on line 1.19, I would like to remove the word state and replace it with the word public. I think my lawyer hat is telling me that it's it'd be fine the way it is, but I do want to make it clear that we're encouraging programs that would work in concert with any of our public parks, not just state parks. So I would move that amendment on line 1.19 to replace the word state with the word public.
No one heard the amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
All right. House File 133 is known as the No Child Left Inside bill. I will acknowledge the incongruity of the first hearing of this bill occurring on maybe one of 3 days in the entire year where I actually would not be encouraging my kids to play outside. But I, you know, I think the other 362 days of the year were good. So it's just an interesting
that we ended up the schedule this way. And that being said, my kids played outside for several hours on Monday. They're fine. You bundle them up, you send them out, they're good. So this bill would establish a grant program through the DNR for programs to encourage kids to spend more time outside and encourage kids to establish better connections with their natural world. And so the reasons for this are extensive. In your packets, there are a couple handouts about the effects on health and well-being as well as academic outcomes. And I will also mention that these handouts, unlike a lot of handouts we get, are extensively notated with the scientific studies. You know, so there's little numbers behind every single, you know, bullet point on these handouts showing you the numerous studies showing the multitude of positive reasons we want to encourage kids to spend more time outside. So as many of you know, I'm a mom. I have elementary school age kids. They are 8 and 4, and this program is not for kids like mine. For myself, I had the privilege to grow up in rural Minnesota with parents and family who, you know, really fostered a love of nature and spending time outside, you know, whether that's setting up deer stands or looking for sheds in the woods, you know, blueberry picking, all those kind of, you know, checking the maple syrup tap lines with my uncle, you know, all those kind of things. And a lot of the folks that end up in the Environment Committee are also folks who probably already do those things with their kids. But the reality is that a lot of Minnesota kids do not have access to those things. And so what this bill would do would open up the door for more programs and more connections so that we can get more kids outside. I would also note that this isn't a program that would only benefit kids in urban and suburban areas. I think I myself grew up in Cass Lake near Bemidji. You know, any families who live in any city center really and don't have the means and the access and the familiarity, as well as some of our newer refugee and immigrant communities, may not have the comfort with our great Minnesota outdoors that some of us native Minnesotans would have. And then I do also want to be clear that this is in no way meant to replace or supplant the current Triple R programs, the recruitment and retention programs that the DNR does. We know, we talk about in this committee, and especially in environment finance, because of the impact when we don't have people buying licenses, we know that the numbers are down on the number of people that hunt and fish and buy those licenses in our state. And so I think this really is a way to help in that respect as well. As a policy issue and increasing the number of folks who hunt and fish as adults. You know, if you're not comfortable walking around in the woods to begin with, the chance that you're going to also want to walk around in the woods with a firearm and take up hunting is not very good. I think we need to start at a base level where we have an understanding of conservation principles and just a comfort in being in the woods, being in the prairies, and being outside. So this work would take a step in changing that and probably, you know, hopefully helping with those recruitment numbers. And I want to thank Joe from Presence Forever lent me his book. So a lot of the movement on some of related issues is there's the nature principle, if folks have seen this book, and Last Child in the Woods was the kind of the first book in the series that talks about this issue. Finally, I'll add that the next step for this bill, obviously, is Ways and Means on its way to environment finance. So being mindful of time and the previous discussion, you know, really happy to discuss the policy implications and talk about this bill. And I had other testifiers from one of the nature centers in my area, but staffing concerns with their kids and stuff, they weren't able to make it today. So I promise to hopefully even have some kids show up the next time we hear this bill in the next committee. There's also letters of support from Conservation Minnesota, and I believe someone from Conservation Minnesota may testify, as well as a letter of support from the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails group as well. So happy to take questions or move on to testifiers.
Very good. And I'd like to get the testifier just so they may answer some of the questions that are going to be asked. But Mr. Paul, please. And okay. Let me ask you.
Yeah.
Representative Beckerman, there's a letter from this Elizabeth Blackwell, but she's not here. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, very good. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Nels Paulson. I'm the Policy Director at Conservation Minnesota. And I'll try and be brief in my remarks. I'm sure Mr. Meyer wants to voice his support for this bill before we adjourn. But I just want to draw your attention to a letter of support that Conservation Minnesota should have found its way into your packets. And towards the bottom of this letter, I just wanted to highlight that Conservation Minnesota feels that if some of this programming that's already happening with our conservation partners, things like the Four Corn Camp that the Minnesota Deer Hunters run, or Woody Camp, or any number of hiking or paddling camps. These are great programs, and we support them. But if some of these programs are good, we think more of these programs are better. And we particularly support opening up this type of grant opportunity to non-conventional groups who might not always be at the conservation table. And what comes to mind are groups like healthcare organizations, faith groups, agricultural groups, and school groups. Anyone who cares about the outdoors should have access to the ability to share that care and that knowledge with today's youth. So thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Paulson? Seeing none, thank you. And if we could, Mr. Meyer, would you please come forward and impart your wisdom, and then I'm going to get
to the Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And while I can't formally endorse this bill currently because of the governor's budgetary process we're going through, I can speak to the need of it. Representative Beckerfin and I discussed this briefly yesterday, but we have a ton of programs out there. The ICANN series, we can teach you how to camp, canoe, rock climb, hunting, firearm safety, ATVs, snowmobile, all of those things we have. But getting the people to those facilities or to those programs sometimes is a barrier, or actually having them know of them or gain that trust in the community. There's a lot of people out there who are afraid to go to the state parks because they're afraid to sleep in a tent. But they don't want to go by themselves. So if we can build community-based kind of support, hearing from your peers, say, hey, this is really cool, let's go camping or let's go try fishing, is important. And getting that from the local community to come be involved in our programs is really where I think this will be beneficial for us. Having that trust at the local level, especially in certain areas of our state or our populations, really is important, so they can come out as a community rather than an individual. And this is a gap that is out there right now. So I appreciate Representative Beckerfin for working on this, and we look forward to working you out with the bill as it moves forward.
Thank you. And just stay there for a minute, if you would, Mr. Meyer, and we're going to go to questions real quick. I have Representative Green on the list first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and yeah, I'm glad Mr. Meyer is staying there, and I wish there was a whole bunch of other groups here too, because they're in my office all the time. And we have health groups, DNR. We put money into watersheds, districts, parks and trails. There's almost nothing that we don't do in the way of environmental committee that doesn't put something into trying to get the kids outside. And so one question I have is, why are we kind of reinventing the wheel with a new program instead of looking for the gaps in the programs that we already have and trying to fill those in? Because what we're going to end up here with is one whole another pot that keeps sucking money out, and we don't even know if it's going to work, because Representative Beckerfin, you know as well as I do that when it comes right down to it, the programs are there, but if we're not seeing the amount of activity we want, you can't go into the house and say to the parent, we're taking your kid outside. I mean, the parents have to have some responsibility here. And so why not work with the programs that we have instead of trying to do a whole new one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you actually make a good point in that this isn't meant for the people who are already in this room. The point is that it would fill the gaps that we have in connecting the programs that we have with local community groups. And as an example, at my kids' elementary school, the fifth and sixth graders do a trip every year to Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center. And when I was talking to the PTA and talking to the principal about that, there are families who opt out of that. And the reason they opt out of that is because they just get the permission slip and there's no actual engagement with why that's a thing they would even want to do. Because we, as I think a lot of us who already do all these activities, take it for granted there are folks who don't feel that way. And so, and a lot of times the families who are opting out are newer immigrant and refugee families who this isn't the environment that they grew up in. And so wouldn't it be better if, for instance, a Hmong community group or a Somali community group did a program that helped bridge that gap so that we do have better engagement with the programs that we already have? It's not meant to just be the same groups who always come here asking for money. The whole idea is that we're addressing a gap that does exist.
Well, thank you, but it doesn't really answer the question because you're still creating another entity or whatever you want to call it instead of just expanding the ones that you've got. But, you know, we can go there another time too. But the one thing that if you've followed anything that I do, I very much have trouble with the rulemaking authority that the agencies have. And in this bill, you bypass that. They don't have to go out into the public and ask for comment on this rule. It's just go ahead and make the rules that you need without getting any public comment. Is there a reason for that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're doing it out in the public right now. We're changing the law as a legislator.
But you're also allowing the agency to make rules that will not be in this room.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, that is a good question and one that's often confusing to people when they see this type of language in a bill. The decisions that we would need to be made under this program, you can see it's outlined in basically 1.14 to 1.20, provide opportunity to students with directly experience and understand nature and the world, use research-based, effective environmental, ecological, agriculture, other base education curriculum. These would be the criteria that we establish for the grants. So, why should we spend the time going through a Chapter 4 rulemaking process for these decisions that are specifically outlined in the bill? So, for example, the amount of match, the types of programs that are allowed. If we don't have that language, that exemption, we would be required to go through a Chapter 14 rulemaking process to make those decisions. That would be the reason for the exemption. We take rulemaking at the department very seriously. As you know, we have a lot of exempt rulemaking procedures to establish our hunting and fishing seasons, things of that nature. But when we do need to make a decision, either it's going to be rulemaking or an exemption from rulemaking that clarifies which way we go. So these are, I don't want to call them mundane decisions, but more administrative type decisions that we feel don't fit in with the typical rulemaking process.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation. There again, I don't know that I agree with that, but that's a fight we're having in another day. I do think that we have a lot of programs out there. I'm just not really comfortable starting a new one when I think that, the options are there, and the things that you just said that you could do with rules because they're in the law now, you're doing with the other programs already. We already have information out there that goes to the schools. And I'm just not sure that putting more money into the same process that you're already doing instead of expanding the programs we already have is the right way to go, but here we are.
I have Representative Aiken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question. As a former environmental educator, I certainly appreciate the benefits of bringing all people, youth especially, out into nature, and it goes beyond even some of the benefits that you listed, and really once you get people to appreciate and value our natural environment, they're going to work hard to protect it. And so I think that's just an added benefit. So that's just a comment. But then I also wanted to ask a quick question about kind of the focus of who's being targeted maybe. And I guess I didn't see a lot of that in the bill. And I've heard you talk a little bit about maybe focusing on underserved or under maybe newer to the country immigrant populations. And just so, are there programs that are currently do that? Maybe speaking to the former representative's question about are there established programs that are reaching out into those communities? And I guess I didn't see, and maybe I missed it, are there specifics in your bill that that's kind of a priority of this legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to do it as a grant program is to open it up to the public, because I think I'm always very aware that we tend to only hear from the same people over and over again. And so the idea with this process is that we would open it up. I didn't want to get into the definitions of who fits into what category, but I think, you know, if we're looking at these priorities of maximizing the number of participants, you know, the providing students with opportunities to direct, you know, it's, I think it, it will be up to the DNR obviously to decide, you know, to kind of vet the programs that apply. But I think if you're trying to maximize the number of students, you're necessarily probably going to be looking at some of those underserved communities.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned, this is to Representative Baker-Finn, you mentioned conservation learning centers. I believe we've got four, I believe, in the state that are pretty active. I happen to have one in my district. I don't see anything here, I'll be very parochial about this, that would focus students that wouldn't normally get there because their schools may not be able to provide the impetus or the funding, or, you know, there's a lot of things. How you plan to get those kids to that area? Because that would eliminate a lot of the logistics, a lot of the, particularly for people that are just absolutely not, haven't been in the woods, so to speak, for any reason, because and maybe the DNR can expound this, because this, in general, this looks, I think the heart's in the right place, but I think we've already got some world-class learning centers, and I would suggest this be much more directed toward how do you get those that are not able to get there now for a variety of reasons to those places. That's where the professionals are, rather than sort of throwing it out and let somebody else reinvent the wheel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would say that the idea is not that that this bill just be a way to pay for transportation. The idea is, I think you have to think a more organically and community-based about the opportunity to fund programs that are community-based and then make the connections with the things that we already have that exists. Because if it's just putting out funds to pay for the transportation, people who don't feel comfortable outside are not even going to ask for that opportunity. And you know, and maybe Commissioner Meyer can speak to the struggle of, you know, you can walk into a community as a DNR staff person and it's a different thing than for it to come from the community itself and have the community stepping up and making the connection.
I would just, first of all, let's get rid of the word transportation. That's a part of it. I can just tell you, the folks at all of those learning centers would just love the opportunity to go right to any of those communities and deal with it. And that's how we make that linkage. And so, again, I would suggest that there's a whole lack of going to the right people. That, I mean, they're out there marketing, trying to show what they've got to offer, and I can tell you, they will be there right now. They may need some language assistance and some other things, and they need the guidance and the perspective of that community, because so that all kinds of things are met because there are a lot of people that, particularly if they're new here, there needs to be an accommodation for those things. So, again, I the heart's in the right place, but I think you're going way over, and there's a real simple linkage needs to be made here.
Mr. Chair. We cannot just keep thinking that we know best and that we can send someone from the dominant culture into another community and that when they say, listen to me, this is what you need to do, that that community is obligated to trust and engage with that person. I mean, that is really what we're what you're talking about, and thinking that, like, just because we're going to have someone who markets things come in and talk to someone in Representative Gomez's community or Representative Wagenius's community, and that the folks who live there are then obligated to just listen and trust everything they say, that is the gap that this program would fill, is that we are not just relying on the things that already exist. We are giving an opportunity for other folks to fill those gaps who already have the connections.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you your program is not going to go very far if you're going to go around and you're going to label people you don't know, and anticipate how they're going to deal with other human beings. I find that your comments about that dominant community very offensive. And again, I know individually a number of people that work at the Long Lake Conservation Camp, and on their behalf, I think you ought to apologize to them because that was a very unfair statement.
Mr. Chair. I will not apologize. There is a majority culture that exists. Stating that fact is not itself offensive. And, you know, perhaps Representative Gomez and some of the folks who represent some of these other communities that are not the majority cultures would have some comments on that. But I think that we have to recognize is that, that there are differences in our community and that sometimes the culture that has all the power is not, you know, we have to open our eyes and open up to the idea that maybe we don't know best and that communities themselves know best how to engage their own communities.
If I may, I would just offer, and Representative Luke, I appreciate just what you said earlier on, heart's in the right place. I think so, too. I think everybody in here's heart's in the right place. But the nature deficit we have doesn't know race, religion, whatever.
That's the point.
And so we got to work everywhere. And I think everybody's here to try and make this good. And I want to thank you all. I've got a couple more testifiers. Question. Ribbon Heitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that we've heard a number of questions come up over the course of the presentation. And I want to get to something I don't think has been covered, and I wish today had been televised because I think that it would have helped some people trying to refer back to this issue. We've heard a lot about we think there's a need. I think that the commissioner spoke very well to there's some gaps somewhere, and I think that it's reasonable to try to look for maybe a solution to some of those questions. But for somebody that is potentially listening at home, I would just walk them through. I'm on the DNR website, which I think is absolutely fantastic. We have a kids page here, Commissioner, and there's all kinds of activities available. And just to run through a few in a moment here, but I'll start with something that I'm very familiar with, and that's, of course, the LCCMR. And if, like I said, people are listening at home, there's, in the last appropriation, 2018, we had over $5 million in programs, four programs, something similar to this. We had the Get Outdoors After School program. We had the Yes Students Take On Minnesota Water Challenge. We had Connecting Students with Water Stewardship through Hands-On Learning, just to name a few, and that's $5 million. I'm not sure what the appropriation might be in this particular legislation. It's not stated. We don't know, and I'm assuming there's a fiscal note that's been requested. But here again, it isn't here. And then I'm looking, like I said, on the DNR page, there's Project Learning Tree Green Schools, Project Learning Tree Green Works, and small shooting range grants. There's also ICANN programs, including fishing, camping, canoeing, and mountain biking. Folks, that sounds like a lot of stuff that's available right now. A lot of good stuff, and it doesn't have any kind of a qualification for who can and can't. They tell certain kids in certain communities you can't participate. That's great. That's the way these things are supposed to work, and it allows everybody who may not maybe have an opportunity to get out into the woods and onto the lakes, as Representative Lewick was mentioning. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think, Commissioner, while you may have pointed out, I think maybe there's some gaps, it seems to me that there's lots of places we could work to try to fill those gaps, and this legislation, I'm confused, I guess, as to how it does that, because it leaves a lot of specifics open, and we talked about rulemaking. I understand your comments, but I also think it makes sense to have that community input, even if it isn't necessarily something that's necessary for what you may have in mind. But just looking at the language here, I'm not entirely sure what we have in mind. But the question specifically I have is, as I was watching the Rules Committee meeting this last week, there was a lot of discussion about process. And Representative Becker Finn, I know you're on that committee. I'm a little confused because being this has a fiscal note, and we brought this up earlier again, why didn't this go to the Ways and Means Committee first?
If I may, Representative Heitzman, we're here to talk about the policy issues, and we'll let the Finance Committee deal with that and Ways and Means deal with that. If that, I don't know what you have in mind particularly to talk about the finance aspects of it. You agree or disagree with the bill, but... go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
Well, I thought since I had the opportunity, I would ask the bill author if there was a reason, and she specifically has knowledge, being as she sits on that committee. So I was just curious if there was a reason why it didn't go to Ways and Means first, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Heitzman. I'm dealing with, we got more folks coming in this room. We're over time, so I could you perhaps speak with Representative Becker Finn offline on that? I mean, it's not totally relevant to what we're talking about here.
Mr. Chair, you're being very amenable. I appreciate your comments. I sincerely do, but I'm not really speaking for myself. I think the public has a right to know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker Finn.
We've had a vigorous policy debate here already. So that's why it came to the policy committee. As for why there's not a dollar amount, we don't have we don't know what the February forecast is, and we don't have our budget targets yet. And so that's why there's a committee process, and there's multiple steps in the process. And I do want to make sure that our base programs are funded. And as I stated before, you know, really the idea with this is that we're not supplanting any programs, it's supplementing the programs that already exist. As far as, you know, if there are things that you have in mind about ways we can make sure this is more targeted at specific populations, then I'm happy to talk to you about that. You know, we both serve on the Environment Finance Committee, and happy to talk at length with anyone who's got their heart in the right place and wants to get this bill in better shape. So happy to do that with you. Appreciate the policy discussion today, and thank the everyone for their time, and the chair for kind of your latitude in letting us go over time. So thank you.
And it seems the more questions we have, the more we get. So I'm going to say got a couple more people on the list, and we're going to be done. We've got to be. So. Representative Hansen.
I will defer those because the bill is coming to the Finance Committee and will be properly noticed so the public can look at that and participate, as clearly there is members of the public in the audience today, and we will try to make sure it's online. So I will defer my question.
Thank you for your accommodation, Representative Hansen. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Becker-Finn, I don't see anything specific in the bill with regards to awards being granted or grants being awarded to minority communities, and I understand a portion of that probably, but can you tell me why you didn't include that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to leave any good projects out. so that, you know, the communities where you maybe don't have, I didn't want to get into the whole thing as far as anyone being left out. If there's good programs, I think there are kids in every single one of our communities that could benefit from more programs and supplementing the programs that we have, regardless of their race, you know, background, immigrant status, whatever it may be. I think that there are potential to get that this program could help really all kids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure we'll have conversations in Chair Hansen's committee with regards to which fund is going to be used or as. But I do, Representative Becker-Finn, I would ask you to reconsider some of your earlier comments with regards to the conversation you had with Representative Lewick. Quite honestly, I don't know who has appointed you to be the final arbiter of what's offensive and what's not offensive, but when you say in testimony, in public, that stating a fact is not offensive, that's troubling to me.
Stating a fact is not offensive.
I'd like to leave it at that, unless I'm very surprised we went anywhere like that in the first place, to be honest with you. Representative Gomez, got you on the list.
Yes, you do, Mr. Chair. I know that we're having time issues. I guess I'm surprised at a lack of kind of basic understanding about the history of our country, where we are, like what the realities that people in Minnesota are living with, as indicated by some of the conversations that we have had today. I'm surprised at the kind of, I guess, like hostility. I don't even know how else to characterize it that I have seen toward the author of this bill, who I think, you know, we can all agree brought this forward in with the intention of getting kids to play outside, right? Like, nobody's trying to be the arbiter of any kind of grievance or whatever. I mean, I apologize. I'm just a little bit less surprised at the tenor of this conversation and the direction that it's taken. I do just want to say two things real quick. You know, I grew up in Minneapolis. I was raised by a single mom. She's a school teacher in Minneapolis Public Schools. She taught English as a second language classes. She taught after-school classes. She taught weekend classes. She taught summer school. She worked over our vacations that we shared. Honestly, it's sort of like me now working in this body. Like, I've one of the things I've had to study, right, in addition to, like, trying to figure out tax policy and whatever, is, like, the state of Minnesota. I have not had the opportunity to travel it very much. I don't know about a lot of the beautiful communities that you all live in. And I'm trying to get acquainted with it. There are a lot of kids in communities like the one that I serve who don't have access to just the information, the kind of trust that somebody would need to allow a person to take your kid out of town. Like, there's an organization in my community called Tamales y Bicicletas, and one of the things that they do is they take kids to the boundary waters, and it mostly serves Latino kids, and so I was like a board member of them for a while, and you know, these are kids who live in the city, again, whose parents are just like working all the time and don't have the chance to take their children out into the beautiful places in this state, and so this organization has built trust, has built relationship, has built built enduring relationships with families. And frankly, the DNR in my community, like, does anybody even know what the DNR is? The DNR doesn't, I know they do fishing in the neighborhood. I guess that's like a program that happens in urban waterways, but I'm not aware of other programs that exist in my district, at least. And so to me, like, the idea that Representative Becker-Finn is bringing forward here is like, how do we utilize some of these organizations that have already built the trusting relationships with families in communities? How do we leverage those relationships to help connect kids who don't have access to outdoor recreation to those opportunities that exist, right? That exist, as to Representative Green's point, Heintzman. I'm sorry, I'm learning everybody's name. But to your point, right, the DNR page, like how do we do the work to connect folks to the resources that exist in our state that we're using tax dollars for, that we're using the Lessard Sands or LCCMR money or whatever it is for, I guess I just want to say that I understand that, you know, if you have a nature center in your district, if you have a lot of DNR programming in your district, if that's something that your residents interact with, like, that's great. But those aren't the kids who we're trying to serve with this program. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate everybody sitting and listening. And any other public testimony? I've got to ask that question. Seeing none, I'm going to ask no further discussion. Representative Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 133, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion passes. The bill is referred. We stand adjourned. Thank you all.
Okay.